Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading today from the October 23rd, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has two women in the traditional Supreme Court black robes on the right-hand side, staring straight into the camera with a big smile on her face and her arms folded, is the Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. On the left side is former Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's got a pensive look on her face, and her eyes are cut looking at Miss Barrett. The title is The Replacement. How would Amy Coney Barrett change the Supreme Court? And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Barrett's contentious confirmation hearing. What happened? Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett told the Senate Judiciary Committee this week that her personal views wouldn't influence her judicial rulings, as Democrats attempted to cast her as an ideologue who would vote to strike down the Affordable Care Act and overturn Roe v. Wade. On the second day of Barrett's confirmation hearing, the conservative appeals court judge declined to answer Democrats' questions about her views on cases regarding gun control, abortion rights, same-sex marriage, and the Affordable Care Act. She presented herself as a textualist and originalist in the mold of her mentor, Justice Antonin Scalia, for whom she clerked in 1998. A judge must apply the law as written, not as the judge wishes it were, she said. In their questioning, Democratic senators particularly focused on a legal challenge to the health care law that will be heard before the Supreme Court on November 10th. In a 2017 law article, Barrett sharply criticized Chief Justice John Roberts' legal reasoning in upholding the law, which provides insurance to more than 20 million Americans and guarantees coverage to those with pre-existing conditions. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island said his constituents see Barrett as a judicial torpedo aimed at their essential protections. Barrett countered that she was not hostile to the ACA. Democrats also zeroed in on Barrett's views on abortion rights. The judge, a devout Catholic who personally opposes abortion, asserted she had no anti-abortion agenda, but she conceded she does not consider the 1973 Roe decision a super precedent that could not be overturned. She declined to say whether she would recuse herself from any case related to the presidential election. Republicans focused on Barrett's strong legal credentials and her experience as a working mother of seven. They painted opposition to Barrett, a member of the insular Christian group People of Praise, as based in religious bigotry. The Republicans made no pretense of doubt about the outcome of a confirmation that would cement a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. This is probably not about persuading each other, said Judiciary Committee Chairman Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. All the Republicans will vote yes. All the Democrats will vote no. What the editorial said. The hearings are revealing deep fault lines over the Supreme Court, said the Wall Street Journal. Instead of querying Barrett about her legal views, Democrats have treated the hearings like a campaign rally, focusing on a parade of policy horribles if she is confirmed. It distorts the role of a judge, whose job is to interpret the law, not bend it to her will. As Graham admitted from the outset, these hearings were a charade, said the San Francisco Chronicle. Republicans refused even a hearing to Judge Merrick Garland, President Obama's well-qualified nominee, 8 months before the 2016 election, but in a raw exercise of power are now ramming Barrett through even as voters are already choosing the next president. If Barrett enables the court's right wing to overcome Roberts' reluctance to render radical rulings, she will do more harm to the institution than her tainted nomination already has. What the columnist said. Barrett is a strong, capable, admirable woman, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. But she's no feminist hero. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was an icon because she opened doors for other women. It's reasonable to fear that Barrett, nominated because of her social conservatism and what Graham called her unabashedly pro-life views, might shut them behind her. The Democrats didn't lay a glove on Barrett, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. They have trashed her like they did Brett Kavanaugh if they could. But faced with an appealing superwoman who gave flawless answers, they were reduced to finger-wagging scolds. If they'd listened to Barrett instead of lecturing her, they would have gotten an education in the constitutional reality that the court and the entire judiciary were designed to be different from the executive and legislative branches. Barrett's supposed neutrality is a transparent fiction, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. Her claims to originalism amount to a parlor trick, one that recasts the conservative movement's unpopular agenda as constitutionally mandated. Republicans are all for judicial activism, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post, as long as it serves to move American law in a radically more conservative direction. Supreme Court conservatives gutted the Voting Rights Act passed by Congress, and now they're targeting the highly popular ACA. The Republicans have made a trade-off they now have to live with, said Emma Green in TheAtlantic.com. They accepted Trump's erosion of democratic norms, and in return, he delivered conservative judges. The glittering prize of a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court majority makes some of the damage worth it. But with Trump heading for defeat and control of the Senate in jeopardy, the party may pay a heavy price. Our controversy of the week, the VP debate. What did we learn? As a sequel to the Festival of Incoherent Interruption President Trump delivered a few weeks ago, last week's vice presidential debate was a jarringly normal affair, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. The plexiglass screen separating Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence served as a troubling reminder of the White House coronavirus outbreak. But the candidates traded talking points with a passive-aggressive politesse that recalled the olden days of 2014, before Trump's fateful descent of his golden escalator. Neither Harris nor Pence delivered a knockout punch, but with Joe Biden's poll lead widening just weeks before the election, that means Trump lost. Harris' most effective minutes came at the very beginning, said Shane Goldmacher in nytimes.com, when she delivered a devastating critique of the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic and described the horrifying toll. 210,000 dead, 7 million cases, and more than 30 million filing for unemployment. For his part, Pence tried to portray Biden and Harris as far-left extremists who'd raise taxes and enlarge and pack the Supreme Court. Harris' weakest moment came when she clearly dodged the court question. But the debate didn't change the dynamic of the race, and a fly generated most of the buzz when it landed and lingered for a full 2 minutes on Pence's helmet of snow-white hair. This debate will help the GOP ticket, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Pence's plain-spoken Midwestern common sense was soothing for voters unsure about Trump, while Harris' attack dog derision was grating to viewers outside her fan base. She did not dispel the fears of moderate voters that the California liberal will strong-arm Biden to embrace leftist policies and or replace the doddering 77-year-old to become the 47th president. Harris tried to stick to her moderate-sounding talking points, said Beverly Hallberg in WashingtonExaminer.com, but her body language betrayed her contempt for Pence. Frantic, often choppy hand gestures and a fusillade of squints, glares, and sarcastic smiles. Like every female candidate, Harris had to walk the inch-wide line that separates being submissive from being harsh, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. She had the added challenge, as a black woman, of having to come off as strong but not angry. Harris met these unjust standards with aplomb. Pence embodied unearned male confidence, consistently ignoring his time limits, obnoxiously interrupting Harris, and talking over the female moderator. The unflustered Harris, smiling but steely reminders that, "I'm speaking, Mr. Vice President," may have widened her ticket's 23-point poll lead among women. Pence's mansplaining attempt to dominate Harris probably delighted his boss, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times, but it likely did not impress many women voters. If this debate helped the Biden-Harris ticket, said Alyssa Rosenberg in WashingtonPost.com, it was by reminding viewers of how restfully boring our political discourse can be without a narcissistic Twitter addict dominating every news cycle. The familiar spectacle of two civil, sane politicians dodging questions and trading zingers made a return to relative normalcy feel close at hand. It could be a mirage, said the Washington Post in an editorial. At the end of the debate, Pence dodged a question about whether he and Trump will commit to accepting the election results. How close can normal politics really be if the incumbent administration doesn't know if we should have a democracy at all? Our good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for deer, with new State Farm data showing 70,000 fewer insurance claims this year, a 20% reduction for damage caused by animal collisions. It was a good week for alto males, with new research from China's Southwest University suggesting that women should beware of men with deep voices when selecting a mate. The same high testosterone levels that deepen some men's voices mean they may have more infidelity behaviors, the researchers found. And it was a good week for determination after Brianna Hill of Illinois went into labor while taking the bar exam via video link at home, washed herself off, and finished the exam. Just a few hours later, she gave birth. Definitely a little crazy, Hill conceded. But it was a bad week for Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, whose statues were torn down by protesters in Portland, Oregon, during what they called an Indigenous People's Day of Rage. It was a bad week for fake endorsements after the Trump campaign released a TV ad about the pandemic that included a clip of Dr. Anthony Fauci saying, "I can't imagine that anybody could be doing more." An angry Fauci said he'd been describing the efforts of federal public health officials, not President Trump. And finally, it was a bad week for cursed mementos after a travel agent in Pompeii, Italy, received a package from Canada containing two ceramic tiles stolen from the historic site in 2005. The sender, calling herself Nicole, said she was returning the tiles after lots of medical and financial misery. Please take them back, wrote Nicole. They bring bad luck. In a short news piece before we leave, payments to Trump yield major favors. More than 200 companies, governments, and special interest groups profited in some way from the Trump administration after spending millions of dollars at the president's businesses, according to a New York Times analysis based on the president's tax returns, public records, and interviews with 250-plus people. Clients of Trump's properties, including Florida sugar barons, a Chinese billionaire, and a Serbian prince, reaped rewards large and small. Some got a presidential tweet. Five members of Trump's Mar-a-Lago club were offered ambassadorships. Still others gained access to federally protected land. Just 60 entities funneled almost $12 million to the Trump organization during his first 2 years in office, and nearly all saw their interests advance in some way. On the briefing page now, if Roe falls, why overturning the 1973 landmark ruling won't mean the end of abortion. Is Roe in jeopardy? Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death may change the political balance of the court, but even if conservative Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed to replace her, it won't guarantee the repeal of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision that established a constitutional right to abortion. Historically, Supreme Court justices are reluctant to overturn major precedents, and only one current justice, Clarence Thomas, has unequivocally stated that he believes Roe v. Wade and a companion ruling, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, should be overturned. Barrett has given mixed signals about whether she'll vote to overturn Roe if she's confirmed. In 2013, she said she thought it very unlikely at this point that the court is going to overturn Roe, and that the principle that the woman has the right to choose abortion will probably stand. But as a devout Catholic, she has made her personal opposition to abortion clear. She once signed an ad from a pro-life group describing legal abortion as barbaric. Kelly Robinson, executive director of Planned Parenthood Action Fund, said that if Barrett is confirmed, an emboldened 6-3 conservative majority may overturn Roe. People are understanding that this is real, Robinson said. How would repeal happen? There are several cases now making their way to the court that could provide a basis for a Roe reversal, including a near-total ban on abortions in Alabama that has already been signed by Governor Kay Ivey, as well as a case brought by Whole Woman's Health challenging a prohibition of the dilation and evacuation, D&E, method of abortion. Should Roe fall, the matter would revert to the states. Nearly a dozen states have passed trigger laws that will make all or most forms of abortion illegal the moment Roe is repealed. Seven have passed laws stating their intent to restrict abortion to the fullest extent allowed. 10 other states have passed laws ensuring abortion's legality. If Roe fails, said the Center for Reproductive Rights, abortion will become illegal in 24 states and 3 territories, and remain legal in another 21 states. 5 states could go either way. In a post-Roe country, women in conservative states could still get abortions if they were willing to go to another state and could afford to. But a woman living in, say, Mississippi might have to drive as many as 10 hours in order to have the procedure. K. Can Congress intervene? If Roe were to fall, Congress could pass a national law either legalizing or prohibiting abortions in every state. Meanwhile, the total number of abortions in America has steadily fallen since reaching a high of 1.61 million in 1990. Experts at the Guttmacher Institute, an abortion research group, attributed that decline to greater availability of highly effective forms of contraception, such as IUDs, through the Affordable Care Act. In 2017, the latest year for which data was available, the Institute recorded 862,000 abortions, fewer than in any other year since Roe was decided. Would the number of abortions fall? Yes, but not dramatically. A study from Middlebury College in Vermont found that states most likely to criminalize abortion already had the lowest abortion rates because there are already so many restrictions. Alabama had an average historical rate of 8.3 abortions per 1,000 women ages 15 to 44, Mississippi 8.6, Arkansas 6.2, Oklahoma 5.9. California and New York, both of which would keep abortion rights intact if Roe fell, had rates of 17.3 and 27.4, respectively. New Jersey's was 28.2. The Middlebury study found that repealing Roe would result in a 32.8% reduction in the abortion rate in conservative states, but nationally, America would only experience a 12.8% reduction. Even if the pro-life legal movement locates its holy grail, said pro-life conservative writer David French, almost 90% of the American abortion regime would remain intact. What about mail-order drugs? Today, about 40% of women who end their pregnancies do so by taking the abortion drugs mifepristone and misoprostol, which studies have shown are safe and effective at terminating pregnancies up to 20 weeks. The FDA limits their use to up to 10 weeks and requires women to get them directly from a healthcare provider. Seven states explicitly prohibit their use, and authorities in several states have warned that they violate fetal harm and fetal homicide laws. At least 21 women have faced charges for using them. In the face of such resistance, some women have turned to black market providers such as Aid Access, which obtains the drugs from India and then illegally ships them to women in the U.S. If Roe were to fall, pro-choice organizations would no doubt step up efforts to provide these medications. I don't think you can put all of those different genies back in the bottle, said medical historian Andrea Tone at McGill University in Montreal. Women are in charge of their procreative destiny. Going to pass on the columns this week and go straight into our in-depth article, The Last Word. This week, the title is How the Pandemic Ends. Even after a vaccine is approved, the coronavirus will not suddenly disappear, said journalist Elizabeth Ralph in Politico.com. COVID cases and deaths will decline, but the virus may continue to circulate for years. The microscopic bundles of RNA wrapped in spiky proteins latch onto human cells, hijack them, use them as factories to replicate, and then leave them for dead. It's a biological blitzkrieg, an invasion so swift and unexpected that the germs are free to jump from host to host with little interference. Fast forward to the future. Now, when the prickly enemies invade the lungs, they slip past the human cells, unable to take hold. They're marked for destruction, soon to be surrounded and eliminated, though some escape through the airways. They confront the same defenses in their next target, if, that is, they can get anywhere near the human cells. There are so few people left to infect that the germs have nowhere to replicate, nowhere to survive. This is the end of the coronavirus pandemic, and this is how it could happen in the United States. By November 2021, most Americans have received two doses of a vaccine that, while not gloriously effective, fights the disease in more cases than not. Meanwhile, Americans continue to wear masks and avoid large gatherings. And the COVID-19 numbers drop steadily after a series of surges earlier in the year. Eventually, as more and more Americans develop immunity through exposure and vaccination, and as treatments become more effective, COVID-19 recedes into the swarm of ordinary illnesses Americans get every winter. The scenario laid out above is the likeliest outline for how the pandemic could end, based on interviews with 11 top-level experts who think about the future of these microscopic SARS-CoV-2 particles every day. They agree there's a lot of fog left in the COVID-19 crystal ball, but most accept several likelihoods. At least one effective vaccine, hopefully several, will be approved in the U.S. by early next year. Producing and distributing a vaccine will take months, with the average American not receiving a dose or doses until at least mid or late 2021. And while widespread inoculation will play a large role in bringing life back to normal, getting the shot will not be your cue to take off your mask. The end of the pandemic will be an evolution, not a revolution. The vaccine, just another powerful tool in that process. I don't see this pandemic ending as in, like, you know, this is the day the pandemic ended, said virologist Angela Rasmussen. I see this as being a process that will go on for a long time, potentially even years. Experts' estimates of the timeline vary, but there seems to be some agreement that the virus could be in decline and under control by the second half of 2021, and that society could see pre-COVID normal conditions within 2 years. The precise timing is uncertain, an elusive future that rests on a series of known unknowns, things like how many people continue to wear masks and to social distance, and whether rapid COVID-19 tests can be widely and properly deployed. Much will depend on how effective the vaccines are, how many people refuse to get inoculated, and how many people forget to get their second dose if the vaccine requires two. Yes, that is a significant concern. And then there's what epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, calls the trillion-dollar word of the day with this disease: immunity. How long, on average, will immunity from natural infection and from the vaccine last? The pandemic is far from over. It's not even in decline. Cases of COVID-19 are on the rise in more than 19 states. And in just one day last week, the U.S. saw more than 50,000 new cases and close to 1,000 deaths. As people move indoors for fall and winter and social distancing fatigue sets in, a new surge is likely, underscoring the idea that Americans are not going to achieve normal before a vaccine, not with this country's outmatched testing system and total failure to contract trace. The optimistic prediction is that a vaccine will be ready for distribution by Election Day is looking increasingly unlikely. The two leaders in the U.S. race for the COVID-19 vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer, are still enrolling participants in their Phase 3 trials. In these trials, some participants receive a vaccine and the rest get a placebo. And then administrators wait to see who gets sick. U.S. presidents and CEOs can't control the speed at which that happens. Nonetheless, given the urgency around the world, it's probable that one or several approvals will happen at the end of the year or early next year. Best case scenario, we get a few vaccines that work by December, says Emily Landon, chief infectious disease epidemiologist at University of Chicago Medicine. It could take longer. Larry Corey, who is in charge of coordinating the clinical trials of U.S. government-funded vaccines, has guessed the first U.S. Phase 3 results won't be available until February. Getting a vaccine out to the American people, of course, is a different problem, and a colossal one. Pharma companies and the U.S. government must produce, distribute, and administer around 660 million doses of vaccine over the next year or so, because the vaccines furthest along in trials require two doses per person. Many experts, including the director of the CDC, predict that vaccines could be widely available as early as late spring or summer. But Zeke Emanuel, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, believes that they're underestimating just how difficult it will be to manufacture and distribute doses at scale. Pfizer's vaccine, for example, needs to be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius. No doctor's office has negative 70, said Emanuel. You can't do the usual, you know, this sort of hodgepodge we have of CVS's, Walmart's, Walgreens, doctor's offices, schools. CDC guidelines suggest states prepare to distribute doses at hospitals and mobile clinics, making sure that most Americans receive two doses of the same vaccine 4 weeks apart smoothly and efficiently will be a massive government operation. So let's say it's 2021, and you've just gotten your two doses. What happens next will largely depend on two factors: how effective the vaccine is, and how many people get it. The goal is for the vaccine to be effective and widespread enough for the U.S. population to reach the herd immunity threshold, the point at which, theoretically, Americans can safely take off their masks and attend large sporting events. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, walked through the math. Roughly, about two-thirds of the population would need to be vaccinated if the vaccine were 75% effective against transmitting the virus. If the vaccine is less effective than that, a greater percentage of the population needs to get vaccinated to close in on herd immunity. Experts aren't optimistic that these first-generation vaccines are going to be that highly effective at preventing transmission. Without a highly effective vaccine, the country needs a relatively high vaccination rates. And yet, a whopping two-thirds of Americans say they won't get the vaccine when it's first available, and a quarter say they'll never get it. Many scientists fear that so many people are going to refuse to get both doses of a vaccine out of distrust or fear or just plain forgetfulness that America won't reach a high level of protection, much less herd immunity. Apparently, these shots with COVID, they give you some fevers, some chills. You feel a little flu-like, said Emanuel. Well, how many Americans are coming back to say, oh, I would like that again? I would like to feel a little under the weather for a few days to get this vaccine. What I worry about is we have a lot of people who are only partially immunized with one shot. That a vaccine will not be totally effective is not a reason to panic. Any vaccine is going to be a big help in containing the pandemic. Even if you don't get herd immunity, the closer you get to it, the slower the virus spreads, says Florian Kramer, professor of vaccinology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. 50% effectiveness, the FDA's hurdle for approving a vaccine, is not that little, but it won't enable people to attend the theater or cozy up to their favorite dive bar right away. Adds former CDC Director Tom Frieden, I think even with a vaccine for the indefinite future, Handshakes are out and masks are in. The key to figuring out what's possible with a vaccine, Emily Landon says, is patience. You give people a vaccine, and then some proportion of the people will actually get the vaccine, and some proportion of them will be protected. Next, you wait to see whether the COVID-19 disease and death counts go down, which will take about 2 months after people receive their doses. If they do, you can ease some restrictions. Eventually, if the country doesn't open too quickly, Landon says, there might be limited outbreaks in some places, but the majority of us can get back to most of the things we used to do. We can have, you know, some parties, some gatherings. She thinks we could get there by spring 2021, but that it will still take a couple of years to put the pandemic in the rearview mirror. The world will probably live with COVID-19 forever, even after inoculation. I think a lot of people seem to think that vaccines automatically eradicate viruses, said Rasmussen, the virologist. They don't. To date, only two viruses have ever been officially eradicated. If protection from vaccines is found to wane within a year or so, as some people fear, Americans might end up getting yearly COVID-19 booster with their flu shot, which is what Landon predicts. Getting exposed to COVID-19 will be a crucial part of developing protection. Eventually, you'll have enough people who have built up a little bit of immunity, whether that's through vaccine or maybe you've been infected once. And then the next time you get exposed, it actually serves as a natural boosting event. It boosts your immunity instead of harms you, said Harvard epidemiologist Michael Mina. Let's say somebody turns 60 in 5 years, he games out. They're 55 years old now. They get a vaccine next year, and maybe they get an exposure. By the time they're 60, they might have had two or three exposures, and so they won't be at risk anymore when they're 60 because they've now gained enough immune memory. Kramer envisions that in the long run, people will get vaccinated or infected when they're kids, building up more immunity through revaccination and re-exposure. And by the time they are really in the high-risk group, which starts at 50, they probably are not going to have a severe disease anymore. But they might get the sniffles, he said. At the same time, experts are crossing their fingers that treatments and therapies are going to get better, so that those few who do end up with severe cases are vastly more likely to survive. An antiviral drug, which weakens a virus if you take it early enough, would be a game changer, said Landon, but that's some years away. Faced with this calculation, it's possible large portions of American society will decide not to follow the inexorable track back to normal. Perhaps masks will become the norm in winter when coronaviruses spread more rapidly and handshakes won't return. I think there's going to be a fundamental fear, said Michael Kinch, director of the Center for Research, Innovation, and Biotechnology and Drug Discovery at Washington University in St. Louis. My grandparents lived through the Depression, and for the rest of their lives, even when they had money and some degree of financial security, they to a degree acted like they were living through the Depression. And that's not meant to be gloom and doom, he adds. The new normal will be fine, and we'll get through it just fine. But I don't think we'll go back to January in my lifetime. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in Politico.com. I'm going to read both the obituaries for you today. One is from the music that I grew up listening to, and the other is for you old school baseball fans. So we start with the virtuoso who changed the sound of rock guitar. Eddie Van Halen, 1955 to 2020. Eddie Van Halen spawned a legion of imitators, but none who could make an electric guitar sound quite like he did. In his hands, the instrument could growl, dive bomb, and shriek. It issued machine gun burst, stadium rattling riffs, and shimmering arpeggios. Shaped by his mastery of the two-handed tapping technique, using both hands on the fretboard of his homemade Frankenstrat guitar, Van Halen's sound reshaped rock forever. It also drove his namesake band to superstardom. Starting with their eponymous 1978 debut album, Van Halen, featuring Eddie's brother Alex on drums and the antic vocalist David Lee Roth, became one of the top-selling acts in history, with a multitude of pop metal hits such as Panama, Hot for Teacher, Running with the Devil, and Jump, and 10 multi-platinum albums. "I'm always pushing things past where they're supposed to be," said Van Halen, who died of cancer last week at age 65. "When Spinal Tap was going to 11, I was going to 15. Van Halen was born in the Netherlands to a Dutch father and an Indonesian mother, said the Washington Post. His father was a classically trained clarinetist and saxophonist, his mother a homemaker who faced harsh racism. To escape the bigotry, the family in 1962 immigrated to Pasadena, California, where his mother worked as a maid and his father as a janitor and dishwasher who played gigs on weekends. Eddie and Alex were trained on the piano before turning to rock, inspired by such groups as the Dave Clark Five and Cream. Eddie slowed down the latter's records to learn his hero Eric Clapton's guitar solos, note for note. At Pasadena City College, the brothers formed a band called Mammoth with Roth and bassist Michael Anthony, said the Los Angeles Times. They played backyard parties in high schools before graduating to Hollywood clubs. In 1977, Warner Brothers president Mo Austin caught a sparsely attended show and signed the by-then-renamed band on the spot. The Times from UK. Recorded in 3 weeks, Van Halen flew a defiant flag for traditional bone-crunching hard rock in an era dominated by punk and disco. "The next 5 years were a blur of sold-out arenas, wild parties, and smash albums," said Rolling Stone. But ever-growing success amplified tensions between the Van Halen brothers and Roth, who left in 1985. He was replaced by Sammy Hagar, who sang on a string of best-selling albums before clashes with Eddie drove him out in 1996. A 1998 album with a third singer, Gary Cherone, failed to connect with fans and was drubbed by critics. "A dark period followed for Van Halen," said the New York Times. The guitarist struggled with alcohol and drug use and in 2000 was treated for tongue cancer. He got sober in 2008. 4 years later, with Roth back in front, the band released its first new album in 14 years. A string of sellout tours followed before worsening health forced Van Halen off the road. While he contributed a blazing solo to Michael Jackson's 1983 hit Beat It at no charge, Van Halen otherwise devoted his life to the group, never seeking outside projects. "There was no need," he said. "I'm just a guitarist in a kick-ass rock and roll band. What more could I have asked for?" The crafty Yankees pitcher who won 6 World Series. Whitey Ford, 1928-2020. Whitey Ford was the greatest starting pitcher to ever put on the New York Yankees pinstripes. Standout member of the Bronx Bombers in the 1950s and 60s. No mean feat considering the dynasty included such legends as Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, and Yogi Berra. The street-smart New Yorker helped turn the Yankees into perennial champions. Known as the chairman of the board for his steely resolve, the 10-time All-Star won 10 World Series games, still a major league record, and once threw a record 33 2/3 consecutive World Series innings of scoreless pitching. a swaggering southpaw who relied on craftiness, Ford believed three ingredients made a successful pitcher. Arm and heart are assets, he said. Head, a necessity. Edward Charles Ford grew up in the New York City borough of Queens, where his father ran a bar, said the New York Times. As a high school senior, Ford attended a tryout at Yankee Stadium and was told he had a powerful pitching arm. After a summer throwing balls with a Queens Sandlot team, he signed with the Yankees in 1946. Nicknamed Whitey for his light blonde hair, Ford went 9-1 during his stellar rookie season in 1950 and won the decisive Game 4 of the World Series against the Philadelphia Phillies, said the Washington Post. He was drafted into the Army in 1951 and spent his 2 years of service at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, where he starred on the post baseball team. Army life was rough, he joked. They actually wanted me to pitch 3 times a week. Ford had an average fastball, said the New York Post, and relied on curveball sliders and, he later admitted, spitballs and other unsanctioned pitches. He used turpentine, resin, baby oil, and dirt to sharpen his breaking pitches and cut the ball with a specially designed ring. A scientist on the diamond, he was often wild off it. Yankees manager Casey Stengel called Ford, Mantle, and Billy Martin the Three Musketeers for their late nights on the town, one of which went famously wrong in 1957. Celebrating Martin's 29th birthday at Manhattan's Copacabana Club, Ford and his teammates got in a brawl that left a patron with a broken nose. The players were fined over the headline-making scrap, and Martin was traded to Kansas City. Ralph Hoke replaced Stengel in 1961, said the Wall Street Journal, and the new skipper didn't bother trying to preserve his ace. Without innings restrictions, Ford posted a 25-4 record that year, winning the American League Cy Young Award. But in the 1964 World Series opener, Ford developed numbness in his left hand, the result of a blocked artery. Circulatory and elbow problems dogged him until 1967, when he walked off the mound mid-game. Ford retired with 6 World Series rings and a career 2.75 earned run average, the best of any starter that century with 200-plus wins. He remained one of the biggest draws at Old Timers Day. I've been a Yankee for 53 years, he told fans in 2000, and I'll be a Yankee forever. Got a couple of health and science articles for you. Start with COVID-19 can damage mental functioning. Almost a third of hospitalized COVID-19 patients suffer some lasting form of altered mental function, ranging from mild confusion to delirium to coma-like unresponsiveness. That's the conclusion of the largest study to date of neurological symptoms among coronavirus patients in the U.S. Scientists examined the records of 509 coronavirus patients who were treated at Chicago area hospitals in March and April, 162 of whom developed encephalopathy, a catch-all term for any brain damage, disease, or dysfunction. The patients with encephalopathy remained hospitalized 3 times longer than those without. After being discharged, only 32% said they could handle day-to-day activities such as cooking and paying bills. Patients with encephalopathy were also nearly 7 times more likely to die than those without. Only about 25% of those with lingering neurological symptoms had been sick enough to require ventilators. Overall, 82% of patients hospitalized for COVID-19 suffered some neurological symptoms for a period of time. The researchers didn't identify why COVID-19 causes encephalopathy, but many experts suspect the neurological effects are a result of severe inflammatory and immune system responses that often damage the other organs. This study highlights that for survivors of COVID-19, when they survive the infection, their recovery is just beginning. Richard Timmis, a neurologist who wasn't involved in the study, tells USA Today, these patients can have long-standing and lingering effects. Coffee after breakfast. If you need a strong coffee to perk you up after a bad night's sleep, you may want to hold out until after breakfast. New research suggests that a cup of Joe first thing in the morning can hamper blood sugar control, a risk factor for health issues such as diabetes and heart disease. For the study, 29 healthy men and women took part in three separate experiments, having a normal night's sleep and then consuming a sugary drink on waking. The drink contained the same amount of calories as a typical breakfast. A disrupted night's sleep, followed by a sugary drink, and then a disrupted night, but with a strong black coffee 30 minutes before the sugary drink. One night of bad sleep didn't worsen the participants' blood sugar and insulin responses, but after the coffee, their blood glucose response increased by about 50%, suggesting the black stuff was impairing the body's ability to cope with breakfast. Nearly half of us will wake up in the morning and, before doing anything else, drink coffee, co-author James Betts from the University of Bath in UK tells ScienceDaily.com. Up until now, we have had limited knowledge about what this is doing to our bodies. And we'll turn over to the talking points page. We'll start with the article, People of Praise, Barrett's Secretive Faith Group. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett's Catholicism is irrelevant, but her lifelong participation in the fringe right-wing sect, People of Praise, definitely isn't, said Joan Walsh in TheNation.com. Barrett's father was a member when she grew up in suburban New Orleans, and the charismatic Christian group is based in South Bend, Indiana, where her family lives now. With 1,650 adult members nationwide, People of Praise is extremely tight-knit. Some ex-members say cultish, with members participating in every aspect of one another's lives. People of Praise oppose abortion and bars openly gay members. It draws on Pentecostalism, including speaking in tongues and direct revelations from God, and places men at the head of the family, with wives taught to submit to their husbands. The question isn't if, but how Barrett's immersion in this traditionalist sect would shape her jurisprudence on contraception, abortion, marriage equality, and women's rights. Millions of American Christians see echoes of their lives in Barrett's faith, said David French in TheDispatch.com. The secular media's description of People of Praise as strange or weird reflects its glaring ignorance about Christianity. Many Christians live in spiritual communities, and outsiders who've spent time at People of Praise services often remark on the deep fellowship and caring among members. As for taking advice from elders, what's wrong with seeking guidance from people who've demonstrated wisdom and spiritual maturity? Referring to men as the spiritual heads of households is common in evangelicalism, said Nicholas Rowan in WashingtonExaminer.com. And yes, women members of People of Praise used to call themselves handmaidens, but so did the Blessed Virgin Mary. So it's entirely fair to ask questions about this group, said Massino Vaccioli in Politico.com. As a Catholic scholar, I can tell you that Amy Coney Barrett is not Catholic like John F. Kennedy was Catholic, or Joe Biden, or Paul Ryan, or the late Antonin Scalia was Catholic. Barrett didn't disclose her membership in People of Praise when she was confirmed as a federal judge in 2017. And the group has removed photos and references to Barrett from its website. Why? Is there tension between serving as one of the final interpreters of the Constitution and swearing an oath of obedience to a personal spiritual director? These questions are relevant, and Barrett should not be confirmed until she answers them. And a few short notes, starting with, in the past 8 months, the coronavirus has killed more people than the last five flu seasons combined. The flu killed an estimated 22,000 people during the last flu season, which runs between October and May, an average of 91 people a day. The coronavirus has killed more than 211,000 people since early February, an average of more than 867 deaths a day. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, who's been accused of slowing mail delivery to boost President Trump's re-election prospects, personally donated more than $685,230 to the committee that staged the Republican National Convention in August. 33% of Americans say they still always work remotely, down from 51% in April. 25% sometimes work remotely. 46% of workers report all or almost all employees in their workplaces are back on site. And we'll finish with a quote from Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who says, "Fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.